episode 317 of Late Night Linux. I'm Joe, and it's just me for the intro. Later on, we're all going to be talking about our favourite discoveries from all of last year. But first, we've got a chat with Molly White. Graham and I recorded this with her a few days ago. You may know Molly from Web3 is Going Just Great or her Citation Needed newsletter. So let's get straight on with that. Welcome to the show, Molly.
Thanks for having me.
So it's been a while since we last talked to you. And last time we were talking about the crypto stuff mostly, which is what you're quite well known for. But you are also well known for your involvement with Wikipedia.
Yes.
And that's something that's come up recently.
It has, yeah. I mean, Wikipedia comes up pretty often, I guess. But yeah, it has come up recently.
So what exactly is your involvement with Wikipedia then?
Well, I am a Wikipedia editor. I, you know, have been editing Wikipedia for over 18 years now, I think, pretty actively for most of those years. And I've had, you know, various roles in the community. I'm an administrator now. I am a functionary on the site, which is sort of an advanced level of permissions. And I also spent about 6 years on the site's arbitration committee, which is its sort of top dispute resolution body. I haven't been on that recently, but for a couple of years there, I was a part of that.
But that's all been as a volunteer then?
Yes. Yeah. All volunteer. I've never worked for the Wikimedia Foundation or anything like that.
Right. And so you recently wrote a post, Elon Musk and the Rights War on Wikipedia. I would have added the word far before right there personally, but I know you're quite diplomatic. Tell us a little bit about this piece you wrote then.
Yeah, so Elon Musk and other members of, I would agree with you that it's the far right. I just try to keep my title short. You know, he and a handful of others have been really going on the offensive about Wikipedia lately, although it's sort of something that he's been yelling about for a number of years now. But every once in a while, it sort of crops up in these far right spaces that Wikipedia has been captured, that it is this leftist project, that, you know, there is this grand conspiracy to turn everyone into socialists or something like that through this sort of biased editing, which is all hand in hand with the mainstream media and so on and so forth. And that came up again recently, right around sort of the holiday season when Musk and the libs of TikTok person and you know, various other folks have been complaining about Wikipedia, this time specifically because they believed that the Wikimedia Foundation had dedicated $50 million towards DEI, which is sort of the latest synonym for woke or whatever the, you know, the slur is.
And that turned out to be bullshit, right?
It did, yes. Much like many things they say, they had really just looked at the foundation's annual plan and they saw the word inclusion and they saw the word equity and they decided that that must be DEI in all of its worst forms.
But it really wasn't that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really would require you to buy into their definition of DEI to agree with them that that's what it was. But, you know, I think they were arguing that this was some sort of, you know, horrible nonprofit excess where they were funneling money towards all of these, you know, hyper leftist projects and all this stuff. But if you actually drill into it, it's really baseline encyclopedia functioning that they're spending the money on. You know, it's about trying to ensure that we attract and retain more editors, that we handle a lot of the really big issues, honestly, with the gaps in encyclopedia content, especially when it comes to areas where there aren't a lot of editors active. And so people don't even really know what to write about, you know, what should be being written about. And then, you know, topics like disinformation and source reliability and handling, you know, vandalism and stuff that, you know, Wikipedia has been doing for over a decade.
Yeah, that source reliability thing is interesting because the far right people will have you believe that any sort of right wing publication is like blocklisted and just not allowed to be cited. But in your piece, you talk about how The Telegraph, which is very much a right wing newspaper, is considered a reliable source.
Yeah. So a lot of these conversations that happen where they're very political often really misunderstand how Wikipedia works and how the editing works, which, you know, I don't really fault people for not understanding it because it is this sort of Byzantine process. But there isn't like this list of approved sources and this list of banned sources, and you can only cite the ones on the good sources list and you can never cite the ones on the banned sources list. Like, that would be basically impossible to maintain. There are so many publications out there, you know, books and academic journals and newspapers and magazines and everything, websites, that you couldn't possibly create something like that. But also it just sort of ignores the fact that reliability is often very case by case. Like, some authors are better fact checkers than others. Some publications do very comprehensive fact checking for all of their pieces or only some of their pieces. You know, things slip through the cracks. There are opinion articles published in publications that also publish very heavily, you know, researched articles. And you might cite one, but not the other. So everything is really very case by case. But what they often are referring to is this list of sources that come up a lot in discussion on Wikipedia, where, you know, people constantly are wanting to cite the New York Times or the Daily Mail or, you know, all of these different sources that are just very widely read. And to avoid having the same conversation 1,000 times every time it comes up, we've had sort of larger scale conversations about the general reliability of those sources, which then provides some degree of guidance for any case by case usage. And so for some sources, the Daily Mail being one of them, you know, there have been such major issues with their reliability, with their willingness to fabricate information or their failure to fact check, their failure to issue corrections when errors are identified, that, you know, they have entered this sort of zone on Wikipedia where we try not to use them. And it doesn't mean we never use them or that they should never be used, but they're somewhat rarely used for good reason. And then other sources, you know, are generally reliable because they have strong fact-checking practices. Their editors will issue corrections if, you know, if there are issues identified and so on. And again, you know, not every article in one of those publications should or can be used, but it does help avoid those conversations. But that list is what often gets sort of misrepresented in these types of discussions, especially by people who are just not super familiar with how Wikipedia works.
But that list does tend to skew left, generally speaking.
It does, I would say. You know, not exclusively, as you just mentioned. I named a couple of publications that are, you know, sort of center-right to right-wing that are in that generally reliable column. And there are definitely left-leaning sources that are considered to be unreliable or, you know, heavily partisan, for example. But there is sort of a left slant to some of those sources, I think, honestly, because a lot of the right-leaning sources tend to be really bad at fact-checking, or they tend to be willing to publish, you know, falsified information. They treat conspiracy theories as fact. You know, they're willing to sort of use this post-truth era that we're in to publish, you know, whatever the narrative may be without much respect for the truth. And because of that, you know, a lot of them have been added to that list because we were just seeing problems over and over and over again with sources coming out of those publications.
Post-truth is such an important term here because Wikipedia has always had this mission to cite sources and be objective about the truth. And that is why these far-right people are attacking it, right? Or one of the main reasons.
Right. I mean, a lot of the people who are upset about Wikipedia are mostly just angry that Wikipedia does not reflect their interpretation of how things ought to be portrayed. Elon Musk in particular has a lot of really personal grievances with the website where, you know, it doesn't describe him as the founder of Tesla because he didn't found Tesla. You know, he joined early on and he won a lawsuit because he wanted to be called that. But that does not sort of rewrite history in the way that he would like. And so Wikipedia just explains the facts. And, you know, there are instances where there isn't, you know, one accepted truth on something. You know, if you go to the article about God, for example, it doesn't try to make claims that it's true that God exists or doesn't exist or any of the other claims. But it does, you know, we do try to describe any sort of mainstream viewpoints or, you know, commonly described viewpoints in proportion to how prominent they are. And so it does mean that if there is a fringe theory on something, you know, we will discuss it if it is a noteworthy fringe theory. You know, we talk about like the flat earth theory on Wikipedia because it's noteworthy, but it doesn't mean we describe it as a factual state of affairs. And in a lot of cases, I think that's what upsets people who are on the right, who want Wikipedia to say that, you know, the 2020 US presidential election was stolen or something like that, because they believe it to be true. And so because of that, they think that everyone else needs to as well.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by Servomania. Go to servomania.com/LNL to get 15% off dedicated servers recurring for life. Servomania is a Canadian company with over a decade of experience building high-performance infrastructure hosting platforms for businesses globally. Servomania has up to 20 gigabits per second network speeds in 8 locations worldwide for optimized global reach. They have flexible custom server configurations tailored to unique needs, as well as a personal account manager offering free consultations. With 24/7 live chat support and support ticket response times under 15 minutes, you can always keep your systems running smoothly. Alan Jude from 2.5 Admins has been a happy Servomania customer for over 7 years. So support the show and join him at a hosting provider that truly delivers. Get 15% off dedicated servers recurring for life at servomania.com/LNL and use code LATENIGHTLINUX. That's servomania.com/LNL and code LATENIGHTLINUX. A lot of the media will try and have this kind of false equivalence. Like they'll try and put up both sides as if they're equal. I mean, that happened with climate change for the longest time.
Right.
The BBC, for example, would do that. They'd have someone who's an expert on climate change and then someone who thinks that it's bullshit or whatever, and they would give them equal weight. And then eventually they decided, well, on that particular topic, no, the consensus is enough that we won't keep doing that. But I mean, Brexit, which is a huge topic that we often make a lot of jokes about on this show, there's a journalist, Emily Maitlis, who talked about this. She was working for Newsnight, a BBC news show, and she said that it would take them 5 minutes to find an economist who would say that Brexit was a bad idea. And then they'd have to spend like 2 or 3 hours to find an economist who would come on and say it was a good idea. But then they would be presented on the show as equal. And, you know, that kind of false impartiality, I suppose, is something that Wikipedia doesn't fall into that trap, because everything's got to be cited. And, you know, it sounds like with the flat earth thing, it's recognized as a fringe idea, but it's not given the same credence as, you know, the reality of the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the goal on Wikipedia. And I would like to think we do a good job of it. You know, I personally share your opinion that there is far too much of that false equivalency and the sort of like view from nowhere approach to media, where the journalist is like, well, I don't take any opinion on this, so here are the arguments, and then they present them as though they are equally valid.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I do think that that is the way to approach these things, where you don't avoid talking about the, you know, controversial opinions or the, you know, the less mainstream opinions, but you do treat them with the degree of legitimacy that they are afforded by experts or, you know, others who certainly are more, you know, knowledgeable about those topics than any particular Wikipedia editor might be. And I think that is something that the news media really struggles with, is sort of this feeling that they have to be completely divorced from the conversation and take zero stance while treating every possible opinion as equally valid.
Do you think that it could be a trap, even engaging in conversation or using like the language of left and right, when all you're trying to do and we're trying to do is remain objective, and it's for other people to interpret whether that has a political bias or not, or reflects the kind of the model of the times? If just some of those publications happen to be right-wing, then that's nothing to do with you.
I think potentially, but I also think there is some value in just sort of acknowledging that, you know, this publication tends to have a left-wing perspective on things or a right-wing perspective, or, you know, sometimes it's not even the publication, it's the author, the individual journalist or whatever it might be. You know, I think that can be useful sometimes when critically reading a piece of media. And I think it can be useful in other contexts as well. You know, Wikipedia often gets a lot of flack, especially, you know, from people on the right, who they hate that Wikipedia will describe somebody as right-wing or conservative or far-right or alt-right or whatever term it might be. You know, they feel like they shouldn't be described as that, or as though, you know, being described as far-right is derogatory, which is, you know, I feel like there's something to be examined there if they're that upset. But, you know, I think it's useful to just say, you know, this person tends to hold these views that fall on this end of the political spectrum. And, you know, that can be useful in evaluating what they're about, you know, and the positions that they hold and where they're coming from on things. And, you know, Wikipedia does not apply those labels itself through interpreting their opinions. It looks at other descriptions of that person. And if, you know, the news media or, you know, academia or whatever reliable sources we're using widely describes someone as far right, then Wikipedia will as well, which I think is, you know, the right way to go at it versus, you know, trying to have this tribunal on Wikipedia to determine where people fall in the political spectrum.
Yeah, but those far right people will tell you, oh, I don't believe in left and right. I believe in globalist, evil Satanists versus us normal people or whatever.
Right.
So it feels like you can't even win with them.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the point is really just to change the conversation to something that, you know, is just not productive a lot of the time.
I worry that engaging people on their terms in with their language, like Joe was saying earlier on about the one economist they could find supporting Brexit, adds credibility to their argument. It kind of it makes it more real than it really is in terms of what is objective and what isn't objective.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly can. And, you know, when it comes to Wikipedia, you know, Wikipedia is reflecting what is being described in mainstream sources. And so the more mainstream sources engage in that type of behavior where they do represent those viewpoints, even when they are very fringe or they're bogus science or whatever it might be, it almost requires Wikipedia to then give credence to those viewpoints. So there is this sort of perpetuating cycle there where Wikipedia is often sort of beholden to whatever decisions outside reliable sources make. But, you know, I personally hope that the sort of average of all sources available works out eventually and that, you know, some sources making poor editorial decisions sort of come out in the wash, I guess, eventually. But, you know, maybe I'm too much of an optimist.
Going back to the funding conversation, there are some valid criticisms of at least the way Wikipedia and Wikimedia request donations, right? Mm-hmm. Like the huge begging banners. That's something that is not uncontroversial within the Wikipedia community, right?
Yes. So, and that's something I noted in my piece is that, like, I'm not trying to say that Wikimedia's fundraising or its spending is beyond reproach. And there's certainly reasonable conversations to be had about how it raises money, how it spends money, where it spends money, all that kind of thing. And I suspect few people have as many conversations about that as the Wikimedia community does. You know, the Wikimedians, the volunteer community, actually tend to be very critical of the Wikimedia Foundation, broadly speaking. There's sort of this weird adversarial relationship almost between the two. But I was really just trying to point out that a lot of the arguments coming from Elon Musk and other folks are just really not those reasonable conversations to begin with. You know, trying to say that Wikipedia is spending $50 million on woke is just like not a useful framing because it's just not, it's starting from a very flawed premise. But yeah, I mean, the Wikimedia community has had extensive conversations over the years about the way these appeals for donations are worded. There's been a lot of concern among community members that they are sort of too dire sounding. A lot of them sound sort of like Wikipedia is in danger of shutting down tomorrow if you don't contribute your $5 coffee spending towards the Wikimedia Foundation, which is not really true. I mean, you know, the Wikimedia Foundation does need sort of continuous funding to keep going, but they have reserves. They're not sort of living paycheck to paycheck, so to speak. And so there, you know, there's been conversations about that. And then, of course, there's been conversations about, you know, does the Wikimedia Foundation need to raise and spend $150 to $200 million every year? And Elon Musk had made comments about, like, you know, Wikipedia can fit on your phone. What are they even spending all that money on? As though, like, all the money needs to be spent is on hosting, like, a single 50 gigabyte file or whatever. Which again is like not starting from a reasonable point, but you could have reasonable conversations about like, okay, could we do this with $100 million instead of $150 million? Or, you know, is all of the spending on conferences useful when it could be going towards infrastructure or something like that? Those are very reasonable conversations, but again, they're not the conversations that we're seeing coming from Elon Musk and various others.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by Tailscale. go to tailscale.com/LNL. Tailscale is the easiest way to connect devices and services to each other, wherever they are. Everyone these days has a VPN as a sponsor, but Tailscale isn't like those. This isn't about hiding your browsing habits from coffee shop owners, and it's not about watching Netflix in another country. Tailscale is a proper VPN for connecting your devices securely. It's great for companies, and it's great for self-hosters. Tailscale runs on all the major platforms and is based on WireGuard. It's really easy to set up without opening ports, thanks to NAT traversal. Tailscale lets you give apps, IDEs, subnet routers, and other nodes in your tailnet secure access to any other resource in your network without exposing that resource to the public. Site-to-site networking lets DevOps connect the infrastructure their team relies on to securely transfer data between resources such as web applications and databases. Tailscale's personal plan will always be free, so support the show and try Tailscale out for free today. You'll get up to 100 devices and 3 users for free at tailscale.com/LNL with no credit card required. That's tailscale.com/LNL. The main reason that I wanted to talk to you was because I'd been having a lot of these thoughts recently about Wikipedia, and I'd seen various far-right people complaining, and then your piece came up in my podcast player, AntennaPod, and you put into words a lot of what I was thinking about. So I was really grateful for that. But it also made me think over the next few days that this is somewhat existential, really, because as big media has bowed down to the MAGA movement, there are very few, if any other, big names on the internet, big websites, big sources of information that are willing to remain objective. And stuff like you're doing is obviously great, but you're not a household name like Wikipedia. I mean, arguably you should be, but Wikipedia is like, you know, everybody in the world knows Wikipedia. And so it is incredibly important that Wikipedia survives and thrives through this, well, at least the next 4 years of potentially really quite a dark time.
I agree. I am very worried about the next couple of years, not just for Wikipedia, but for the media, for academia, for, you know, research in general. There is this really concerning trend, which is certainly not new, but it seems to be escalating, of attacking reliable information, news reporting that, you know, the people in power or the wealthy individuals disagree with. And, you know, often the very same people who claim to be very in favor of free speech, free expression, are filing, you know, strategic lawsuits against public participation to quiet reporters or have news articles taken down. You know, there's efforts to ban books in libraries and schools. There's efforts to, in the US at least, to have regulations that would limit online information about LGBT issues, mental health, things like that, because they're determined to be, you know, risky to children and things like that. There's sort of these censorship laws that have become unfortunately popular. And so, you know, and I personally view access to high quality, reliable information as like a human need. You know, it's not just a human right, but it's a need in order to live and, you know, sort of interact with the world around you in an informed way. And so the less available that is, the more dire things can really get. And so I think it's going to be really important to sort of protect as much as possible the free press, the, you know, free access to information. And Wikipedia is certainly a bastion in that, and one that I'm really hoping will continue to, you know, take a fairly strong stance against any sort of censorship or attempts to sort of intimidate the narrative into reflecting what the people in power hope it to be.
And one of the big things that people can do, obviously, they can donate money, but they can donate their time, which is something that you have made various resources about how to become a Wikipedia editor in 30 minutes. There's a video you did and an article.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people see attacks on Wikipedia and they go, oh, gosh, I should donate. And certainly I think that's great. Obviously, it goes towards things that I think are important. But I do think that one of the most important things that people can do is actually join the editing community and become active in maintaining this shared resource. And I think there's often this belief that, oh, well, I'm not an expert in anything, or I don't, you know, Wikipedia looks really complicated, or I'm not sure if I want to fight about, you know, where the punctuation marks go, or, you know, there's all these different barriers that people run into when they think about editing. But I really do encourage people to just give it a shot, you know, edit something completely mundane. You know, I think in my video, I pull out some book on insects and just like update something in an article about insects. It doesn't need to be the biggest political hot topic issue, but just maintaining the resource, becoming comfortable with editing, becoming active in that community can be a really good way to not only sort of support the Wikimedia projects, but, you know, actually increase the reliability and the quality of the resource that we're working to create.
I think that's such a brilliant idea, actually, especially now, especially with, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and fact checkers, you know, for people who want to divert their energy from fact checking there to putting it in Wikipedia. It does feel empowering, especially as I imagine diversifying and having people from all over the world contributing to Wikipedia is its strength. You know, it's the one thing that people can't undermine.
Right. And I think that's really important. You know, we do have, you know, much like the people on the right like to complain about, there are issues with bias in Wikipedia. They don't tend to be that there aren't enough American right wingers, you know, editing Wikipedia or being represented. It tends to be that, you know, Wikipedia editors are actually overwhelmingly American. And they tend to, you know, be from the global north. They tend to be male. They tend to be white. They tend to be highly educated people working in white collar jobs, that type of thing. And so you lose perspectives for people who maybe don't live next to the town that doesn't have the Wikipedia article in Africa, you know, or, you know, there is some cultural aspect that's missing. There's just these enormous gaps in Wikipedia's articles that, you know, certainly can be edited by people outside of those areas, but are often better maintained by people who have more knowledge about those particular articles. You know, a lot of it is really knowing what we don't know, I think. And so the more editors that come in, the more diverse perspectives are represented and the more gaps we're able to fill.
And there's a lot of articles that could do with heavy expansion, right? Like they're kind of just stubs, I think is the word.
Yeah, there's a ton of articles that are just like a couple sentences long and they exist, but they don't really provide that much information and could do with a lot of expansion. There's a lot of articles that, you know, look like they were written 10 years ago and never really updated. There's so much of Wikipedia that's still very much a work in progress. And, you know, if you go to the article on apples or something, it's going to look like a pretty pristine page because so many editors have contributed to it. But once you start looking at some of the more niche topics or, you know, clicking that random article button and just seeing where you land, there's often so much that needs to be improved on Wikipedia. Much of which is, you know, very non-controversial. You're not likely to get into a fight about it. You know, you can just sort of happily edit away if that's what you prefer to do.
Yeah, and updating citations as well, because often those links will die. And so you need to either find an archive of that or a different source, right?
Yeah, we have an issue on the internet, broadly speaking, but also on Wikipedia with link rot, where, you know, people's websites go offline. Luckily, the Internet Archive has been an amazing resource in terms of fixing that problem. So they, you know, are very actively coordinating and working with Wikipedia editors to sort of automatically add archive links to Wikipedia references, which is an amazing project. But, you know, not everything was archived before it went offline, or, you know, some pages just haven't been hit yet. And you see, or there's an issue often where the original article is still technically a working link, but it goes somewhere else or it redirects or something like that.
Yeah, or it's sign up walled or paywalled. That must be a big issue as well, right?
It can be. Yeah, paywalls are certainly a big issue with Wikipedia and seemingly becoming only more so.
What's the policy on using something like archive.is to like get around paywalls? Is that allowed on Wikipedia?
It's not forbidden. And we do encourage linking to archive websites. There's certainly some concerns around those sort of like dark archives and things like that around like, are these going to be online forever if we don't really know who's running it? But yeah, they're not forbidden. And as far as paywalls go, there's no prohibition on using an article that's behind a paywall. And there are projects with various resources to actually provide Wikipedia editors access to databases that are often paywalled. So there's a project called the Wikipedia Library, which is this amazing collection of databases, you know, often like academic databases that are limited to people who have some affiliation with a college usually. But Wikipedia editors can actually get access to those through the Wikipedia Library and then use those as sources to improve Wikipedia, which has been an amazing resource, especially as I no longer have any sort of university affiliation and lost access to all my precious databases.
Well, it's been absolutely great talking to you as usual, Molly. Thank you very much for joining us. What do you want to plug? Citation Needed newsletter, maybe?
Yeah, my newsletter is citationneeded.news, and it links to everything else if you want to find me anywhere else.
Right. Well, I'll definitely put a link in the show notes. Well, like I said, great to speak to you and hopefully speak to you again soon.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. This episode is sponsored by Automox. Are you prepared for whatever shitstorm may hit your desk during the workday? Automox has your back. Check out the brand new Autonomous IT podcast. Listen in as various IT experts discuss the latest Patch Tuesday releases, mitigation tips, and custom automations to help with CVE remediations. Make new work friends. Listen now to the Autonomous IT podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you tune into your podcasts. On to a bit of admin then. First of all, thank you everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. If you want to join those people, you can go to latenightlinux.com/support. And remember that for various amounts on Patreon, you can get an advert-free RSS feed of either just this show or all the shows in the Late Night Linux family. And you even get some episodes early. And if you want to get in contact, you can email show@latenightlinux.com. I thought we'd do a little bonus and talk about the best discoveries that we've made during 2024. So I asked you to go through the old discoveries. It turns out that the easy way to do this is with Matthew Holder's site, which you can get to from latenightlinux.com/discoveries. That's got a list of all our discoveries right back to when we started doing discoveries, I think. So thank you, Matthew. You've done a great job there. So let's talk about the discoveries that we've kind of stuck with or have made the most impact on us. So, Will, what are yours?
Well, mine are all kind of related. My top one is ThinGeno, which, if you remember, there was a camera provider in the UK that went bust, and they basically said, throw it away. It's a useless piece of crap now. And ThinGeno came along and turned it into a working open source camera entirely local on your network, which I think is a great example of what open source can do for the world and why it's important that projects like this exist. And coupled with that is Motion, which was the open source NVR, which is able to monitor those cameras and report on movement in your house on your open source camera. And also the Spotify car thing hack, when yet again, somebody decided that they didn't want to produce the hardware anymore. And so it was effectively e-waste. And some enterprising open source hackers came along and turned it back into something which you could use every day. And I think that combination is a good example of why we should care about open source.
Graham, predictably, you've put a couple of audio ones in for yours.
Yeah, so the first is OscuRender, which is the thing that makes 3D objects into oscilloscope objects that then generate audio. I think you told me it was responsible for the most unsubscriptions we'd ever had, so I'm quite proud of that.
Yeah, it pissed a lot of people off. They thought that their podcast player was broken, especially people who listen to us while they're going to sleep. Suddenly yeah. It was like just making noises and really freaking people out. So we will not be repeating that this time. Oh. You'll have to find the old episode if you want to check that out.
But it still blows my mind. And I think it's worth mentioning that Jeroboam Fenderson has got a new album out in 2024, and you can get it on 3.5-inch floppy disk.
Yeah, I saw a Tecmo video about that. Looked great.
Amazing. And then the other one is my synth of the year, which I'm an open source synth called Terrain, which is the one that used generated 3D landscapes and then cut a slice across them and used that as a waveform, which I still play with, and it's fascinating.
And you've got a couple of coding-based ones.
Yeah, I have spent some time writing in Ink, which was the interactive fiction generation language, very much a modern version. It reminds me of Quill, an adventure game creator, which I played in the 80s on my home computer. And it's a perfect thing for these long evenings. And then another one kind of related to retro gaming is 8-bit Workshop, which is a web-based IDE for assembler through emulators with real-time output and debugging and pixel editors and also sprite editors. So a whole IDE for retro gaming on the original emulated hardware. It's a brilliant piece of software.
Phelim, your first one is Picture.
Yeah, so the theme of my year has been kind of trying to make documentation better. I haven't sort of gotten around to that yet, but Picture is a nice flowcharting-based documentation system where it is simply just a few commands that you can put in as a text file and then interpret into a flowchart-type document. Really nice, really simple, and it's all stored as text, so it's available in the future when you change your mind. And sort of tying in with that is Clevernotes, which is a markdown editor for KDE. That works out really nicely, allows me to see what I'm doing while I'm editing documents. I only found that near the end of the year, but I intend to fully redo my documentation with it. Very nice.
Is that Clevernotes with a C?
You know it's not with a C. It's with a K. Come on.
And Task Finder as well.
Yeah, Task Finder was one that I found that sort of, it works in a very simple markdown to-do list structure. And you can put things like schedules for when things are to trigger and stuff like that. And it's got a very nice command line interface to it. So really simple and really nice and very happy with that.
And your absolute favorite discovery is Every AI Thing Ever, which you love.
Yeah, it says it's called AI Track. It is not. It is facial recognition machine learning track is what they should have gone for. Essentially, yes, I can use a webcam to control where I'm looking in my flight sim. To be honest, I've used it about twice because I have had zero time to play my flight sim, but it is an excellent tool and it is such a good use of machine learning, looking for faces, not anything to do with AI whatsoever.
So just to confirm, Phelim loves AI.
Yes.
You heard it here first. All right, well, my first one is Innertune. So this is an Android app which basically gives you YouTube music for free. It does break quite a lot because Google changes shit and it's really annoying when that happens. And it's obviously not the Innertune dev's fault at all. But when it's working, it's absolutely brilliant. Highly recommend it. And a YouTube channel that I still watch as soon as they come out, and that is Stez Sticks Fix. I talked about this when Popey was on, I think. And this is a guy who repairs electronics. He gets them under the microscope, tests all the capacitors and replaces components and stuff. It's a very wholesome channel of, let's see if we can fix this knackered bit of electronics. And his success rate is pretty high. So it's very relaxed. There's no stupid jump cuts and all that. And, you know, trying to be funny. Although he does do these annoying raps at the beginning when he thanks his patrons. But he puts timestamps in to skip that, so it's all good. But yeah, highly recommended Stez Sticks Fix. A command line tool that I have used absolutely loads as well, which is related, is YTDLP. And I use the snap of that, thanks to you, Graham.
Thanks.
And every time I update it, I think of you because I see your Degville name there. And it's just a command line tool to download, not just YouTube videos. It works for like iPlayer and I think like Vimeo and just loads of other stuff as well. Probably works for Monkey JPEG sites, although I've never tried it.
Probably.
And Linux Mint 22 is still on. Probably my favorite laptop, the XFCE edition, of course. I installed that early on in the year, thinking that I wouldn't stick with it, but I have stuck with it, and it's great. It's like Zubuntu, but just a little bit more polished, really. I haven't changed any other machines to it. I don't know why, really, but it's on my X1 Carbon with an 8th gen Intel. So it's quite an old machine, but it's a super lightweight, sort of plasticky machine that I just chuck around the house to watch YouTube videos and stuff like that on. And Linux Mint has been absolutely great, except when it comes to printing. I bought a Brother printer because everyone said, oh, it'll just work. And with Zubuntu, it just works fine. Linux Mint 22, no dice. So I do have a Zubuntu partition that I boot into to print stuff with. But apart from that, it's been absolutely flawless.
I'd love to send that back to 2017, Joe, to hear him say what he thinks of you using Linux Mint.
Yeah, well, you know, eventually you just get old enough to just not care about stuff and just want things to actually work. And I like being able to just close the lid and reopen it and not have to put the password in and hope that I'm not putting it into Telegram or something. Because that's what happens with Zubuntu. Like, it's locked, but it doesn't look locked. And Yeah, there's just little bugs in Zubuntu, which, you know, I put up with on all my other machines, but just this one laptop, I've been really enjoying Linux Mint 22. Right, well, we'd better get out of here then. We'll be back next week when it'll probably be news and stuff, but we'll have to see. Until then, I've been Joe.
I've been Phelan.
I've been Graham.
And I've been Will.
See you later.